Last time then we dealt with the imamate of Hassan al-Askari, the 11th and penultimate of the imams, and the circumstances under which a majority of Shi'is came to believe that he did indeed have offspring, who is the 12th of the imams, who went into occultation and whose return under circumstances later to be examined is anticipated and expected. When running through some of the different groups that existed among the Shia after the death of the 11th Imam, in the apparent absence of a physical offspring, I mentioned a large number of titles, but omitted to mention maybe the most important of all titles. The Khafiyyah really stand at the opposite extreme from the Lahadriyyah. You may remember those people who contented themselves with saying we don't know what happened. The Lahadriyyah. The Khafiyyah are those, by contrast, who are certain. The Khafiyyah means those who profess certainty. And that of which they are certain is that indeed the 12th Imam had a son that was born before his departure from this world and exercised the imamate and then went on to occultation. And it is now to the occultation of the 12th Imam that we turn. This unfamiliar term, occultation, which you would rarely find outside the context of Shi'i theology or literature on Shi'i theology in English, is deliberately chosen in order to convey something of the specificity of the concept. The word we are translating here is the Arabic word Ghayba, which has the central lexical meaning of absence. But of course the nature of the absence is important for us to understand with particular respect to the concept of the occultation. Sometimes the word is also described as concealment, or is translated as concealment, but this again is not entirely adequate. So there is indeed concealment, there is indeed absence involved in the concept of a ghaiba, but in order to convey something of its specific flavor, it may be good to use this unfamiliar word, occultation. Occultation, we will describe in detail precisely what is involved, what is the specificity of the ghaiba of the 12th Imam. To begin with, we can say that it consists of two unequal and dissimilar stages, which are known respectively as the lesser and the greater. The lesser occultation, the greater occultation. The lesser occultation in Arabic is called al-ghaibat al-sughra, al-ghaibat al-sughra, the lesser occultation, and the greater occultation as al-ghaibat al-kubra. These two Arabic words are not important. Do not bother to note them. Do note the word ghaiba, but these adjectives are not crucial. The lesser occultation comes first. Begins in the year 260 of the Islamic calendar, 874 of the Common Era, and ends in the year 329 of the Islamic calendar, 940 of the Common Era. Now, and the greater occultation begins, obviously enough, in 329, 940, and continues down to the present. So from this chronological imbalance, one can see in what sense the first of the occultations is lesser. This is a much shorter duration than the major occultation, which continues down to the present and will, from the point of view of Shi'i doctrine, continue to an unknown point in the future at which the Imam will return. The second point of difference between the two types of occultation is the following. The lesser occultation is an absence or a concealment of more familiar type. In other words, the Imam is physically present upon earth, living a biologically normal life. His whereabouts are, however, unknown to all except a small group among his immediate followers and agents.
He is therefore inaccessible to the majority of the community. Access is had to him only sporadically and only through a single named representative. So one may say that the lesser occultation in this sense is simply an intensification of, or even a continuation of, the circumstances that have prevailed during the imamates of the 9th, 10th and 11th imams. That is to say, seclusion, enforced seclusion because of the danger of persecution from the Abbasid caliphs, from the great majority of the community, being represented only by a certain number of intermediaries and appointed representatives. However, the circumstances are different now in the period of the lesser occultation, in that the whereabouts of the imam is not known. It was known during the imamates of Ali al-Hadi, of Muhammad al-Jawad, Ali al-Hadi, and Hassan al-Askari, where they were actually in residence. The difficulty was in gaining access to them. With respect to the 12th imam, during the period of the lesser occultation, his whereabouts are not commonly known. A second important difference between the lesser occultation and what went before is that there is only a single agent connecting him with his followers. And this implies, therefore, an enhanced importance for the position of the agent representing him. Earlier, in the times of the preceding imams, the 9th, 10th, and 11th, there have been a variety of agents, among whom it may presume that some indeed have seniority and a supervisory function with respect to the others. In the time of the lesser occultation, however, there is only a single named representative who acts in exclusivity as the intermediary between the concealed imam and his following. All of this changes with the onset of the greater occultation. The greater occultation, as already remarked, is infinitely longer, is from our present vantage point of indefinite duration, and more importantly maybe, it is no longer a question of the imam being physically present upon earth, although in a location deliberately kept secret. He is rather no longer present on the earthly plane, and it is here that it becomes useful, if not necessary, essential, to introduce the term occultation, in order to prevent the misunderstanding that this is simply a concealment on the earthly plane. What is meant here is that the imam is no longer on the earthly plane, but also has not suffered death. He is, if you like, in a state of suspension between this world and the hereafter. And here we come to another important analogy or aspect, attribute shared with Jesus from the Muslim point of view, who is likewise, as it were, temporarily withdrawn, although for an extended period, from earthly existence, and will return at the end of time. So occultation means this. It means an absence from the earthly plane that does not involve death, an absence that will necessarily be brought to an end by a renewed presence upon earth for the fulfillment of certain predetermined functions, which we have already sketched in connection with that hadith which speaks of the 12th Imam as al-Mahdi al-Qa'im, or al-Qa'im al-Mahdi, the one who will rise up at the end of time to enact universal justice. So this in general is what is implied by the lesser and the greater occultations. The first of the two occultations is lesser in duration, and it is also lesser in that the imam, although his whereabouts are unknown, is still actually living upon earth. The second and greater occultation is that which is obviously very much longer in duration, and in which the imam is no longer present upon earth. Moreover, as we shall come to see, the period of the lesser occultation does involve the presence upon earth, not only of the Imam himself, but also of a succession of named, identifiable individuals. Once the greater occultation begins, the named individuals who represent the authority of the Imam and act as intermediaries with him, they also, the series also comes to an end. So not only the Imam is withdrawn from earthly existence, he no longer has a single named representative to whom reference may be had in order to learn his teachings and to express loyalty to him. And that, of course, brings about an extremely important change in the structure of the Shi'i community, and above all, its organization and the exercise of authority within the community. Let us now turn to this important feature of the minor occultation, or the lesser occultation, the presence of named representatives of the Imam who act as the intermediary with him. To the representatives, a variety of titles are given, one of which we are already familiar with, Wakil. Remember, Wakil is the representative of the Imam, but before the beginning of the occultation, before the beginning of the minor occultation, there are numerous Wakils. Numerous representatives of the Imam in a variety of centers of Shi'i population. After the beginning of the Vema, the lesser occultation, there is but one Wakil. Or better to say, there is only one person who bears the title of Wakil, as he of course has in turn his nominees and representatives who act under his authority. The difference being that now at the head, as it were, of the pyramid of authority and administration within the Shia community, there is a single wakil who acts on behalf of the hidden imam, or the occulted imam, and beneath him a variety of other individuals. Because of this new development in the time of the lesser occultation, that is to say, the emergence of a single individual as the representative of the Imam, often, in fact more frequently, the word that is used to designate this representative is Safir. Why? Because the word Wakil, as I've just tried to indicate, has a certain ambiguity. It is a carryover from the previous period when there were numerous Wakils. Now there is but one person bearing the title of Wakil. And therefore, no doubt, to avoid possible misunderstanding, most commonly we find the word Safir as the title of the sole representative of the Imam. The word Safir, of course, in present day usage and even earlier, has the sense of envoy, even ambassador, in a diplomatic sense. And the choice of this term Safir is in itself interesting, because it does imply, indeed, a greater distance between the Imam and his loyal followers under the conditions of the occupation. It is as if, from a distance, he is sending his envoy, his representative, his Safir, to the community. And finally, among the titles given this single named representative during the period of the lesser occupation, Bab, which is of course quite simply the Arabic word for door or for gate. The representative is also known as the Bab. Why this title? Maybe we have here an echo of that hadith which we cited very early in this course, the hadith in which the Prophet designates Imam Ali as the gate to the city of knowledge. Ana madinat al-ilm wa aliyun babuha. What is implied, I think, by the title Bab, both in that hadith and in this context, is exclusive access. In just the same way that hadith tells us that the only gate of access to a certain body of special knowledge held by the Prophet is Imam Ali, likewise, the only access, the only authentic and true access to the Imam during the period of the lesser occupation is the first note of the Bab. Another important implication of the word Bab is that, of course, the gate may be either open or closed. This is in the nature of things. And it can be said that at the very end of the lesser occultation, this gate of communication is closed. This gate of a particular type of communication to a single name, the authoritative individual, this gate is closed. And it is also significant to jump to a very different period in history that the movement known as Baha'ism starts with an individual who advances through a series of increasingly ambitious claims. The first of the claims that he makes is to be the Bab. That is to say, centuries after the closing of this particular gate, this individual, Sayyid Ali Muhammad, called himself the Bab. That he claimed to be, for the first time in many centuries, the exclusive gate of communication with the occulted Imam. And from then, in quick succession, he ambitiously advanced from one claim to another. Then he next claimed to be the Imam himself, and then a new prophet, and then the way was open for still further exaltation in subsequent generations. But this, however, is the origin of the term Bab in this particular context. The period of the lesser occultation sees a succession of four such named individuals. Four persons who held these various titles, most commonly Safir. Their exercise of the office can be said to have sprung directly from the circumstances of the imamate in the immediately preceding period, the period of the 9th, 10th, and 11th imams. It was an outgrowth, an adaptation, a modification of the general agency of the imams that had already existed. To recapitulate, or maybe to repeat what I have said, this institution of the agency representing the imams to their followers first begins to emerge in the time of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, the fifth imam, takes more visible shape during the time of his successor, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, and has the various functions that I've already indicated, above all the collection and the forwarding of the khums, not only for purely fiscal purposes, but as a tangible sign of loyalty and allegiance to the imams. There is a new aspect, of course, now to the office of the single wakil. That, again, may be said to grow out of the preceding period. You will recall that the transition from the period of one imam to the next was generally accompanied by some degree of disagreement and dissension within the Shia community, rival claims to the imamate often arising. And it is true, of course, that since the time of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, the principle of succession had been fairly clearly articulated as nas, that is to say, a witness, written designation of the next imam by the existing imam. However, in practical terms, how was the nas to be made known to the community as a whole? And it is here that we see the wakils already, before the beginning of the occultation, playing an enhanced role in the lifetimes of, again, the 9th, 10th, and 11th imams. It is precisely the wakils who come forward and testify that they were aware of the nas, that they had been indeed the witnesses of the appointment of the subsequent imams. They have witnessed the drawing up of the document. So in a sense, this endowed the wakils with a high degree of authority. They were to some extent the arbiters of the transmission of the imamate from one imam to the next. This enhancement of the role of the wakil, of the representative of the imam, seems to have been enhanced still further during the time of Imam Ali al-Hadi, which you will recall is a relatively lengthy period, but the imam being confined in Samarra, in the new Abbasid capital of Samarra in northern Iraq, he was unable to communicate with his congregation. I've already run through the administrative functions of the wakil, including now also testifying to the designation of the successor. We can also reconstruct from the theories of Ali al-Hadi the nature, the organization of the network that existed. Ali al-Hadi, the imam, was of course resident in Samarra, and his principal wakil was resident there together with him. But it's possible to draw a kind of a pyramid of authority in this period, which includes a wide variety of other locations. So if we imagine Samarra at the head of this pyramid, it is there that the imam plus his wakil are resident. His chief wakil. Remember, the title wakil at this time can be assigned to more than one person. But then, under the authority of this, as it were, central wakil, we have regional wakils. One, for example, in Baghdad, another in Basra, another in Qom, and another in Medina. And then under the authority of the wakil in each separate place, Medina, Qom, Basra, and Baghdad, there appear to be further local representatives operating under their authority. So then, answering to the wakil in Baghdad were representatives in Kufa and Nada'in. Nada'in being the locality near Baghdad. Then, under the authority of the wakil in Basra, a representative operating in the city of Ahwaz. Ahwaz, which is in southwestern Iran in terms of present day geography, and one of the earliest centers of Shiism in Iran, except of course that the people of this particular province are not ethnically and linguistically Arab. Then Qom, which I've already spoken, and under the authority of the wakil of Qom, we know that there were agents operative also in Hamadan in western Iran, possibly elsewhere as well. And then, under the authority of the wakil in Medina, agents in Egypt and the Yemen. Two places where today, of course, 12 regimes is non-existent. So a fairly complex and sophisticated geographical structure already existed at that time. What is particularly worth noting is that the only person to know of the identity of these four wakils in Medina, Qom, Basra, and Baghdad was the supreme wakil in Samarra. In other words, one can presume that the wakil in Baghdad did not know who is the wakil in Basra. And likewise, this restriction of mutual acquaintance transferred to the next level also, so that, for example, the agent of the Baghdad wakil operating in Madain will be ignorant of, will be deliberately kept ignorant of, the identity of the wakil operating in Kufa. So a sophisticated and widespread network that took all necessary precautionary measures. And the utility, or even the necessity of these precautionary measures, is for an obvious reason, namely the ongoing threat to the position of the imam, and therefore to the Shi'i community in general. But of course, there are two aspects to the matter. On the one hand, yes, this semi-clandestine structure was the result of fear and persecution. On the other hand, of course, it enabled a relatively smooth transition, despite everything, to be made from the period of the physical presence of the imams on earth into the period of the occultation. In other words, something of the administrative network that was to be needed was already in place, although new functions were added to it, and a slight reworking took place in that now there was but one person bearing the title of wazir. Another development that points in the same direction, an administrative development in the time of the last imam, pointing in the same direction of an enhanced importance for the representatives, was that the position became hereditary. The position of the chief wakil became hereditary. We've already mentioned, the name of Uthman al-Omari. Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Omari. Who began as the chief wakil in the time of Ali al-Hadi. He becomes the first of the four named representatives in the time of the lesser occultation. So here we have in a single person a clear instance or a clear fact of continuity between pre- and post-occultation periods. He is the chief wakil in the time of Ali al-Hadi, the 10th imam, and he becomes also the first representative, named representative of the imam during the period of the lesser occultation. But there is more to it than that, in that his son, the son of Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari, becomes the second named representative in the time of the lesser occultation. It is almost as if there is a kind of a mirroring, of course it's an intermediate lesser level, of the circumstances of the imamate itself. The imamate, of course, doctrinally speaking, is a matter not of hereditary succession but of divine appointment, although clearly the outward appearance is of hereditary transference within a single line. And if one looks at the matter from this point of view, then a similar tendency can be observed among the named representatives of the imam. It is said that Imam Ali al-Hadi told Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari that you should continue to be the chief wakil in the time of my successor, i.e. The 11th imam Hassan al-Askari, and that beyond that, when the 12th imam is born and goes into occultation, you should be his wakil, his sole representative, intermediary with the community, and that after you, his son should become that. In other words, a comprehensive prescription already in the time of Ali al-Hadi for how the community was to organize itself after the beginning of the occultation, a naming of an individual and beyond that even of his son in advance for heading the administrative structure of the community. So these various developments point already before the beginning of the occultation to the great importance of the administrative structure in securing the continued existence and administration of the Shi'i community after what is undoubtedly one of the greatest crises in history, the beginning of the occultation, and a period of confusion about the very existence of the imam. Now, once this lesser occultation had begun, what were the precise functions of the wakil, of the single named successor. I'm sorry, not successor, representative. Beyond what is already implied. Firstly, two contradictory, or at least contrasting, purposes and functions. First, in the face of widespread confusion and doubt, even within the Shia community, let alone beyond it, to confer the existence of the Imam. To confirm that indeed the Imam had a son who had survived his death and actually existed. This is, in a way, is a repetition of, or is comparable with, the function that the wakil had earlier fulfilled, i.e. Witnessing to the community at large that enough a designation of a successor had taken place. And now he had to do something even more crucial, confirm that the Imam actually existed. However, at the same time, because of the peculiar circumstances, while confirming the existence of the Imam, he had to conceal his whereabouts. Obviously, a difficult and even a contradictory task. He had to conceal his whereabouts even from the existence of the community. For all of the obvious reasons, that the Imam's entering into physical concealment at this point was intended to withdraw him from public visibility and the possibility of physical elimination by the Abbasid caliphs. So on the one hand, to confirm that the Imam existed, but on the other hand, it was not possible to supply precise evidence of his whereabouts in order to substantiate the claim that he existed. From a pragmatic point of view, a difficult task. And therefore, we find that the wakil, or the safir, rather than offering evidence of a more familiar pragmatic type about the existence of the Imam, lay heavy stress upon the various hadith that have been in circulation for a long time and which pointed to the necessity of the existence of the Imam. These hadith we've already reviewed before. And it can be said that these hadith maybe were more influential in the long run in bringing about a consensus within Shiism that the 12th Imam existed than the accumulation of evidence, eyewitness accounts, indications of time and place about the Imam. So that it was necessary, even within the Shia community, to conceal the existence of the Imam while affirming that he actually did exist. Whenever Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari and his successors in this position were asked, where is the Imam? Have you seen him? They would answer only the second question, yes, we have seen him. They would not answer the first question, where is he? With respect to the broader Muslim community, or specifically the Abbasid Caliphate and its supporters, the Safir had a quite different function. Increasing still further the complexity of his task. What he was meant to do with respect to the broader community was to keep them guessing, to encourage confusion. Within the Shia community, confusion needed to be dispelled. A consensus had to be established, primarily on doctrinal grounds, that the Imam existed. For the broader community, particularly the political authorities, confusion was highly desirable. In other words, did the 11th Imam die with issue or without issue? This was a question on which it was desirable that the caliphal authorities should be kept guessing. It seems that initially, certainly during the early part of the Messenger occultation, the Abbasid caliphs and Sunni opinion at large were convinced that Imam Hassan al-Askari had died without issue, that no son was left, the imamate as an identifiable and viable institution had come to an end. And this conclusion, of course, had beneficial results for the Shia community, in that it was thought that minus an imam, minus an immediately accessible, visible, identifiable imam, the Shia community would lose its raison d'etre and gradually dissolve. And therefore some of the restrictive measures that had been continually intensified were relaxed. And this, of course, further facilitated the operations of the wakil in administering the Shia community. This is not only a matter of the Abbasid Caliphate. It seems that early Sunni opinion, that is learned religious opinion among Sunnis, also was that the 11th Imam had died without leaving a son. Somewhat later, a kind of a compromise belief arose among many Sunni authorities that the that the imam had indeed had a son. In other words, that Hassan al-Askari had a son. But this son had died at the age of 9 somewhere in Morocco, and obviously had not therefore left any descendants of his own behind. The source of this belief is a little curious. It is probably a reflection of the hadith that we find in Sunni sources that there will be after me the 12 khalifas, there will be 12 caliphs. And insofar as there was a tendency, 12 caliphs from my family, from my descendants. So acceptance of this hadith implied that there should be 11, I'm sorry, there should be 12, and therefore if there had simply been 11, therefore there was a sense of a lack. There had to be a 12th son, and therefore who was the 12th? Yes, the son of Imam Hassan al-Askari, but he died. So there was an acceptance of a total of 12, but obviously a wish, in fact a determination, to avoid what is, from the Shia point of view, the essential corollary of that belief in the 12th Imam, that he is in a state of theta. Therefore, a natural biological death was posited for this 12th Imam. Somewhat later again, in fact considerably later, in around the 15th, 16th century, we find a further evolution in Sunni belief concerning the 12th Imam. That, yes, he had had a historical existence and had lived to adulthood, but the particular lineage of the Imams had indeed come to an end thereafter, and he bestowed successorship rather upon the Sufis than instead of upon himself. An interesting development, which is simply illustrative of the developments at that particular point in Islamic history, cannot in any way be taken as a statement of historical fact concerning the evolution of the Imamate. These two functions of the wakil: first, to confirm the existence of the imam to the Shia community while concealing his whereabouts; secondly, to encourage confusion among the non-Shia; and then, of course, the collection of the khums and of other taxes of a religious nature. It remained the task of the wakil during the period of occultation to collect the khums and to forward it. Despite what we have said about the reinforcement of the administrative network and the enhancement of the role of the wakil, there were some claimants to the the function and the title of the wakil after the beginning of the Nasr occultation. And these are connected, not surprisingly, with the khums. People wanted to get their hands on the money. A mechanism, therefore, had to be elaborated for distinguishing the real wakil from his unauthorized competition. And the criterion that was established again goes back to the pre-occultation period. You may recall that the claim of Imam Hassan al-Askari to the imamate was disputed by his brother Ja'far. Ja'far, who was known to Shia tradition as Ja'far al-Kadhdhab, Ja'far the liar. And quite apart from all other considerations, it was said that one of the signs whereby an authentic imam may be recognized is his ability to know intuitively the amount of the khums that is being conveyed to him. And on one occasion, a caravan bearing khums from Qum was coming to Samarra, and Ja'far was challenged to establish by intuitive means the amount of the khums in question. And he, not surprisingly, failed to have it failed to guess correctly, and this same criterion was then applied after the occultation to the wakil. If the wakil were able to judge correctly the amount of the khums that was being conveyed, and even as a supplementary criterion the identity, the names of those who were bringing it, then indeed he was the authentic wakil to whom khums would safely and legitimately be paid. But failing that, failing such knowledge, then he should be dismissed as a false claimant. One can see here how not only an administrative function, but even what you might call a spiritual attribute, a particular quality and ability, is devolved from the imams to their named representative. That is the ability by paranormal means to estimate, to guess correctly the amount of khums being conveyed. Last among the distinctive functions of the wakil in the time of the Nasr occultation, most important of all, communication with the imam in his place of concealment. Communication with the imam in his place of concealment, because we are dealing now with concealment, with the imam being in a specific geographical location, which is concealed from others. The wakil would refuse to answer the question, even from trusted members of the Shia community, where is the imam? So, in other words, the place of concealment had to be concealed. According to the most common account, the place, however, the place of concealment was the Hijaz. That is to say, was Mecca and Medina, primarily the latter, the city of Medina. You may recall that in childhood, the 12th Imam, according to common belief, was secretly conveyed to Medina by his grandmother, who was able to make the journey on the pretext of making the Hajj. And it is said that the entire period of the Lesser Occultation was spent by the 12th Imam in Medina. But it was also said that he would emerge from his place of concealment, that is to say his specific place of concealment in Medina, once a year on the occasion of the Hajj. He would mingle with the pilgrims, but would reveal his identity only, or better to say, he will be recognized only by the wakil, the safir, the unique and exclusive representative of him. This annual emergence of the imam from concealment to mingle with the pilgrims on the occasion of the Hajj is significant in a number of ways. Later also, the belief arose that even during the period of the greater occultation, that is to say, when the imam has being removed, as being withdrawn from the physical plane, he might make an annual appearance on the occasion of the Hajj. And one will hear, even today, stories from persons who claim or who imagine that they have actually seen the Twelfth Imam on the occasion of the Hajj. But beyond that, it is, of course, as we shall see, when we talk about the circumstances of the anticipated return of the Imam to the manifest plane, it is in Mecca that he will make his reappearance. In other words, he will make his reappearance at that focal point of the entire Islamic community. He will be seen to return not simply as the leader of a given sectarian movement within Islam that we call Shiism. He will appear to assume his function of general leadership of the entire Islamic community, and beyond that, as we shall see, to spread Islam universally. So it is appropriate that he should not appear, shall we say, at Najaf or Kufa or Karbala, but rather in Mecca itself, rather one of the places associated narrowly, specifically with the sacred geography of Shiism, but rather at that central point of orientation that is Mecca. There is a competing tradition that the 12th Imam entered the greater occultation in Samarra, that city in northern Iraq, where he and his immediate forebears had been compelled to reside. In other words, not that he was taken while still a child from Samarra to Medina, but that he in fact spent all of the period of the lesser occultation in Samarra. It is said that on one occasion the agents of the Abbas Caliph, suspecting that after all Imam Hassan al-Askari might have left a son behind, came to search the house, whereupon he descended into the cellar, that is to say Imam Muhammad al-Mahdi, the 12th Imam, descended into the cellar beneath the house, and from there, through means unspecified because miraculous, entered the state of the greater occultation, that is to say withdrew from the physical plane. This is a less common tradition. The predominant opinion, that which is most strongly supported, is the other, that the Imam spent the period of the lesser occultation in Medina, when it was there that he entered into his greater occultation, and also there, or more precisely in Mecca, that he will return to the manifest plane. If one accepts the authenticity of this tradition, that the Imam during the lesser occultation was resident in Medina, it was in Medina that the named representatives, the four of them in turn, were in communication with him. The communication was exercised in written form, and we have the technical term for a written communication from the Al-Fatih Imam to his named representative, Tawqif. Tawqif, of course, is in general Arabic usage simply means a signature. But as it is applied to the communications of the Imam with his named representatives, precisely because it bore the signature of the Imam. His signature is a sign of authenticity and authority. And from Tawqi, the singular, we have a Boston woman, Tawqi'at, and the signed documents sent by the Imam from occultation to his named representative. Some of the Tawqi'at, or the text, or the documents themselves, have been preserved in the Shia sources, and they concern a large number of matters, mostly of an administrative nature, concerning that all-important, symbolic as well as material question of the Khums. It is noteworthy that at least the texts texts of the Sufi art that have been preserved do not contain anything of a political nature. That is, they do not speak of the necessity of resistance to the Abbasids. They contain nothing of an insurrectionary nature. In other words, we can say that the Imam in the period of the lesser occultation is already anticipating the greater occultation, that which will be of indefinite duration. And therefore the question of short-term political measures and insurrection as to resistance would be entirely irrelevant. How did the Imam, or how did the main representative maintain a communication with the Imam in Medina? How, in other words, how did his talk be art reach him? Not a great deal is known in this connection. How frequent was the communication? It seems that the Hajj was a good season for the messages to pass back and forth. Even if the Wakil, for example, we don't know if the Wakil went on the Hajj every year, even if the Wakil did not go on the Hajj, then presumably trustworthy persons might be given messages to convey in one direction or another. Quite simply because of the large number of people that go on the Hajj. Even the Saudis in modern times have found it difficult to exercise censorship of everything that goes on during the Hajj season because of the large number of people involved, and quite apart from their congenital inefficiency. And to some degree this has prevailed also in earlier periods. Interesting to know that outside the Hajj season, people were often entrusted with conveying letters, documents back and forth, were ignorant and even irreligious people. Why? Because an ignorant and irreligious person was less liable to arouse the hostile attention of the caliphal authorities than somebody known to be a pious member of the Shia community. So any ignorant sinner would do the job. Even sinners had their utility. So these are some of the functions of the Wakil in this important period. Who are the four Wakils? I've already spoken several times about Uthman, Sa'id, al-Umari. He's the first of these four. He entered the service of the Imamate in the time of the ninth Imam, Muhammad al-Jawad. As already mentioned, he became the chief Wakil thereafter of the tenth Imam, Ali al-Hadi. Retained this position in the Imamate of Imam Hassan al-Askari, and as already said, Imam Hassan al-Askari said that after my death, let Uthman be the representative, the Wakil of my son, and then after him, let his son be the representative. So in other words, the succession to the office of Wakil on the part of Uthman's son was predetermined already before the occultation. Uthman had this, is said to have had this crucial gift of being able to deduce intuitively the amount of khums that was underway on any given occasion. In fact, name the people that were bringing the khums, even though he had no previous acquaintance with them. In his time, it seems that the organization of the community actually flourished. This is one of the numerous paradoxes. The Imam was gone from the visible, from immediate accessibility, was now in concealment. But the administrative structure not only was preserved intact, but actually seems to have spread. Firstly, the center of the administrative structure was transferred from Samarra to Baghdad. There was no longer any purpose for it to be in Samarra after the death there of Hassan al-Askari and the transfer of Imam Muhammad al-Mahdi, the 12th Imam, to Medina. Therefore, the headquarters, as it were, transferred from Samarra to Baghdad. more precisely to the Shi'i,
predominantly Shi'i area of Baghdad, known as Kash,
across the Tigris from the main part of the caliphate capital. And from Kash, Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari sent new representatives to additional centers.
And not only these places that we've mentioned,
Medina, Hun, Basra, Baghdad, we also now have representatives of the Wakil, the head of the administrative pyramid, in Azerbaijan, northwestern province of Iran, in terms of present-day geography. Azerbaijan, the city of Ray, R-A-Y-Y. Once upon a time, a large and important city, now just a village to the south of Tehran. And then in Kabul. Interesting to note that Kabul at this period had also evidently a Shi'i community of sufficient size and importance to warrant the appointment there of a representative of the Wakil. Spreading out from each of these subordinate centers in Azerbaijan, Ray, Kabul, as well as the others, were presumably a large number of other more localized representatives, again, ignorant of each other's identity for purposes of secrecy. The secrecy that even now was necessary, despite the partial relaxation of persecution by the Abbasids, is visible in another way as well. Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari was not, as it were, by profession a religious scholar. His profession was rather that of a butter seller. He sold clarified butter. Okay? Clarified butter. Ghee. What is called ghee.
If you don't know what is clarified butter, then it's, I know how to eat it, but I don't know how to describe it.
And the Arabic for this is
a seller of the clarified butter. It's some man. So this man is Said al-Umari,
not by profession.
A seller of butter, and he's therefore
described sometimes as a some man. Obviously, the exercise of any trade would be a useful cover, but particularly to be a butter seller, a wholesale dealer in ghee, was appropriate and useful. Why? Because the khums would sometimes be delivered along with the butter. It would be concealed in the sacks that contained the butter. And it would be brought from outlying places in these sacks, and then when the khums will be distributed among recipients, it would again be packed in along with the butter in order to avoid suspicion. You know also that another of the associates of Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari in this period was a dealer in cotton, and the same applies there. The khums could be concealed in the bales of cotton that were received and then distributed. So this gives us some flavor of the actual mode of receipt and distribution of the khums by Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari. There are two different dates for the death of Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Umari. The more likely is 280 of the Islamic era, 893 of the Common Era. And he was succeeded in accordance with the hadith I've already mentioned by his son, Abu Ja'far. Abu Ja'far presided over his father's funeral prayers and came to exercise his functions, but in just the same way that the transmission of the imamate from one imam to the next was subject to dispute within the community. Likewise, the transmission of the wakala, the agency, from Uthman to Abu Ja'far was disputed. Above all, by a certain theologian
called Ibn Hilal. He claims that there was no
reason for regarding Abu Ja'far as a legitimate successor to his father. However, a tawqid, that is to say a written declaration from the Imam in his concealment in Medina, was received, in which Ibn Hilal was denounced, and thereafter the Abu Ja'far exercised his function without serious opposition from any quarter. What is worth noting at this point, that is to say during the period of the lesser occultation, and specifically the tenure of the second wakil, is a re-emergence of the ghulat. A re-emergence of the ghulat.
The ghulat is a form for those who actually exaggerate.
That is, they exaggerated concerning the attributes, the status, and the function of the imams. They have made their significant appearance in the time of Muhammad al-Baqir and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. They went beyond asserting the unique legitimacy and quality of the imams to claim for them a more exalted status, that they were not made of the normal stuff of biological human composition. They were made from a special body of light stored beneath the divine throne, that they were essentially divine manifestations, that they were superior to the Prophet, and so forth. They had gone into eclipse, but now, in the conditions of the Ghaybah, they make something of a comeback. They had never gone entirely out of existence, but they had simply degenerated into a conglomeration of unrelated groups, not particularly interested in propagating their claims. Some among the Ghulat, however, saw in the new conditions of the occultation a chance to reassert themselves. And most of the names in this condition, in this connection, are entirely because they came and went without leaving any impact. One, however, does deserve mention. A certain Hamad Ibn Musayyab. Muhammad Ibn Musayyab first came on the scene in the time of Ali al-Hadi, in the time of the 10th Imam, and came forward with the remarkable assertion that Ali al-Hadi was God, and that he, Muhammad Ibn Musayyab, was the prophet of this God, was the messenger of this God. Later, as often happens with movements that are doctrinally extravagant, he modified his claims, but not in the direction of greater credibility and acceptability. On the contrary, becoming more and more extreme, ultimately claiming it seems Godhead for himself. There was very little acceptance for the claims of Muhammad ibn Musayyab in his own lifetime, and certainly not in the mass of the Twelver Shia community. However, he did have a certain posthumous influence, giving rise to that particular sect which is known as the Nusayri sect, which still exists in Syria and to some degree in southeastern Turkey in terms of present-day geography. So he deserves some kind of passing notice. There is some confusion on this point
because the Nusayris, you will sometimes find, in fact often, find designated as Alawi, both in Syria and in Turkey. They're called Alawi. Now the Nusayris from what I've already said, at the very best is situated on the upper fringe of Eden of Qulaj Shi'ism. They say it's all kinds of pre-Islamic beliefs, and make great emphasis upon this notion of incarnation. That is to say, each of their leaders in succession is designated as a divine incarnation. And they remain, until fairly recent times, a small minority in Syria and southeast of Turkey. However, in recent times, they have been elevated to some degree of prominence. First by the French, when they exercised the mandate in Syria. In keeping with the usual colonial tactic of employing a minority, a loyal minority, in order to rule over the majority, the French, in their exercise of rule, gave importance and prominence to the Nusayri community, placing them in important positions in the civil administration and in the army. And in fact, the core of the Syrian regime today is provided precisely by the Nusayris. You know, Hafez al-Assad and his son, who is now the president of Syria, they come from the Nusayri community. Bashar Assad, when his father died, and of course it became necessary in accordance with the kind of mixed monarchical republican system that we find in the Arab countries these days. Of course, the only person to succeed such a worthy man was his son, Bashar. The only problem was that according to the existing Syrian constitution, he was too young. And therefore, the Syrian constitution was revised to make the minimum age for the president be not more and not less than 39, which by a remarkable coincidence was the age of Bashar Assad at the time. You'd think they would proceed with a little bit more subtlety, or round it off to the nearest five, but no. 39, not more, not less. And all of the sensitive military and intelligence posts in Syria are held by members of the Nusayri minority. However, it was under the instigation of the French that the Nusayris called themselves instead Alawi, in order to create the impression that they have some kind of linkage with Shi'ism and therefore are basically acceptable. And I can't remember the exact date, but it was, I think, in the mid-1970s that the religious elders of the Nusayri community in Syria came out with a declaration of their beliefs, which was indeed indistinguishable from that of 12 Shi'ism. And they called themselves there no longer Nusayri, but Alawi. I think this is a case of Taqiyya within Taqiyya. In other words, there is no reason to assume that the thugs of the regime of Hafez al-Assad had undertaken a serious study of Shia literature and found it convincing. It was a question, again, of political expedience, a desire to reorient themselves, remarket themselves, in a fashion which would conceal their essentially heretical nature. And renaming took place across the border in Turkey also, in southeastern Turkey, both among the Kurds and the Turks. We have people who call themselves Alevi. And they are, well, their first date is brought about by Hulad. It is not brought about by Kalvashir. If you look at the pronouncements and the acts of the first Safavid ruler, Shah Ismail, the background from which he sprang, it is a Hulad background. Drawing upon some of the beliefs of the Nusayris concerning divine incarnation. So in the short run, the movement of Muhammad ibn Nusayr has little importance. In the long run, however, it does have these two important outcomes. It is the immediate, although obviously not the sole or most important factor in the propagation of Shi'ism in Iran from the 16th century onwards,
then also it gave rise to this small group which for entirely political reasons has captured power in Syria. To return now to the time of Abu Ja'far, or the second Safir, he died in the year 305 Hijri, 917, of the Common Era, after therefore a fairly lengthy and successful exercise of the office, 305-917. So successful was he, in fact, that the Abbasids began to doubt whether indeed the 11th Imam had died without issue, because it seemed to them that the existence of a fairly widespread and well-organized community could be explicable only in terms of continued loyalty to an actually existing and present Imam. And there was therefore a renewal of pressure upon the Shia community. After the death of Abu Ja'far, hereditary succession is brought to an end, and the third Safir is a person by the name of Hussein Nabati. As his last name indicates, Nobakhti, he was from an Iranian family that was prominent in a variety of fields in the Abbasid period, some of them scholars, some of them administrators. And this particular Nobakhti, in fact, doubled, interestingly enough, as the named representative of the Imam, and as the administrator of the personal estates of the Abbasid Caliph. A very remarkable juggling act. He died in the year 937, was succeeded by the fourth and last among the named representatives, Ali Samarri. Obviously, Ali from Samarra. He held the office for only 4 years, and he died in the year 941 without proclaiming a successor. And this, therefore, brought to an end the period of the lesser occultation, the period in which the Imam had been physically present upon earth, although concealed at an undisclosed location, and represented by this succession of four named individuals. Why did Ali Samarri not name a successor? Because it is said, 6 days before his death, he received a tawqi, that is a signed document, from the Imam in Medina, telling him that precisely 6 days later he was going to die, and that he should not appoint a successor. He was to die, and he should not appoint a successor. He said, we have the text extant, prepare your affairs, 6 days from now you will die. Prepare your affairs, 6 days from now you will die. And do not appoint anyone to take your place after your death, for the second occultation has now occurred. Do not appoint anyone, for the second occultation has now occurred. In other words, it is not simply that the institution of the named agent has been brought to an end. In conjunction with that, and more significantly, the second occultation has begun. That is to say, the period of the major occultation. Notice the tense of the verb here. The second occultation has now occurred. In other words, by the time that this tawqi reaches the hands of Ali Samarri from the Imam in Medina, the Imam has already entered into that state of complete occultation, in other words, of withdrawal, removal from the physical plane. There is more to this tawqi, which I will go into later, because he speaks there of some of the circumstances which will accompany and prepare the way for the renewed appearance of the Imam and how authority is to be exercised in his absence in this new period of the occultation. But the last point to be made today is the following, that with the occultation, the second occultation of the Imam, the doctrinal structure of Shi'ism receives another important defining element. I've already laid stress on the fact that normative Shi'ism means the belief in the 12 Imams, neither more nor less. Secondly, that it includes a belief in ghaiba, in the absence of the Imam, and equally important, an acceptance of that occultation, resting upon a delicate but important equilibrium between an aspiration for the ending of the occultation and a patient endurance of the absence of the Imam. This is something I'll try to work out in more detail later, but for the moment try to note this delicate balance that is to be maintained in the absence of the Imam. On the one hand, as a matter of religious duty and fidelity to the truth, as perceived by Shia Islam, one recognizes that the Imam is no longer upon earth. One should not be tempted, as the Imam says later on in this same document, one should not be tempted by those who claim to be the Imam returned. So there is patient endurance. But on the other hand, of course, an ardent aspiration for the return of the Imam. So that in pious usage, whenever one mentions the name or the title of the 12th Imam, one says, of course, may Allah hasten his return. May Allah hasten his return. Ajalallahu ta'ala farajah. May Allah hasten his return. So definitely, desire for that return to be hastened. But on the other hand, going together with that, the patient endurance of the absence until divine wisdom should decree that the return is appropriate. So thanks, I'll break off today and we will continue for our next week.